You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you send and receive calls and texts from your new business phone number. That way, you can run your business from anywhere and respond to clients quickly with Grasshopper's mobile apps. I've used Grasshopper for our show's 800 number, and let me tell you, Grasshopper has never let me down. Be professional, responsive, and efficient with Grasshopper. Get your business phone number today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. Again, that's grasshopper.com/kick. Today's episode is also sponsored by Nadex. Folks, these days, more investors are getting into day trading to take advantage of market downturns instead of watching helplessly from the sidelines. The problem? Day trading can be risky, and trading the downside can be confusing. But binary options on Nadex let you day trade with risk protection built in. You decide your maximum risk and reward, and you can never lose more. And trading downturns is just as easy as trading rallies. Try day trading for yourself on the first and largest American binary options exchange. Trade stock indexes, commodities, forex, even economic numbers. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at Nadex.com. That's Nadex.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. And now, enjoy the podcast.
And people who are enormously dull, they know it. You know, they, at this certain point in their life, they realize they're a dull person. And what they do is they poke you. People will talk to you. Anyway, and they just annoy you, and they poke you and tap you. And you just want to deck them. It's just, so anyway.
And I'm one of those people who does not like.
I thought of that halfway into the poke.
No, there are a lot of people who do this. Do this. Yeah. I got to tell you this. You know what I mean?
Well, they
watch you all the time.
Well, they lean. You get the leaners. They lean on your arm. They just kind of go. Actually, the more dull the story, the harder they lean. Because what they're doing is keeping you from fleeing. That's their whole thing. Because they know it's uninteresting. They go, so we moved all our savings to a CD. Wow. You broke my arm. Look at that. That's how dull that is. You broke my arm.
That's to keep you there under control.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was actor and comedian Paul Reiser kibitzing on the couch with Johnny Carson during a 1987 appearance on The Tonight Show. Since first getting a guest spot on The Tonight Show in 1982, the same year he starred in Barry Levinson's classic film Diner, Paul Reiser made 25 appearances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. The Tonight Show played an important role in his career, and Paul Reiser knows well that Johnny Carson always went the extra mile to make young comics shine. Now Paul Reiser is paying back the favor by bringing Johnny back into America's living room in a new scripted series centered around The Tonight Show in 1972, just after the show moved from New York to Burbank, California. With involvement and approval from the Carson estate, There's Johnny seamlessly incorporates original Tonight Show footage into every episode, building the plot around that night's show. The result is both a hilarious backstage comedy and a heartwarming coming-of-age story told through the eyes of Andy Klavan, a 19-year-old kid from Nebraska who stumbles his way into a job on The Tonight Show working for his hero, Johnny Carson. Today I'll talk with Paul Reiser, who created There's Johnny with his Mad About You collaborator, David Steven Simon. He'll be joined by his fellow executive producer on the show, Jeff Sotzing, who is Johnny Carson's nephew and a former producer on The Tonight Show, and now acts as the keeper of the flame for Johnny as head of Carson Entertainment. They'll talk about meticulously recreating the look of The Tonight Show, both on stage and behind the scenes, why they decided that no actor could fill Johnny's shoes, and some of the true backstage stories that made it into the series, including the time Johnny Carson participated in an FBI sting to catch his own extortionist. Paul talks about his first appearance on Carson and Johnny's impeccable timing and generosity to young comedians like himself. Jeff will talk about his own coming-of-age story as a young kid working on The Tonight Show, and he'll share his memories of his Uncle Johnny, including being there for Carson's final episode. They'll share tales from the infamous Tonight Show writer's room, including the antics of legendary jokester Pat McCormick. They'll recall the rat-packy coolness of the longtime Tonight Show producer Freddie DeCordova, played on the series by Tony Danza, and they'll pick their favorite moments from Johnny Carson's 30 years on television. Coming up with Paul Reiser and Jeff Sotzing in just a moment. Today I'm sitting down with actor, writer, producer Paul Reiser, who along with David Steven Simon is the co-creator of a wonderful new television series called There's Johnny, which debuts on Hulu November 16th. It's a coming-of-age dramedy set behind the scenes of The Tonight Show during the Johnny Carson era of the early 70s. So along with Paul, I have his fellow executive producer on the series, Jeff Sotzing, who was a producer on the original Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and now runs Johnny Carson Entertainment. Paul and Jeff, thanks for sitting down with me.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure.
I can't tell you how much I adore this show. I was only able to watch the first episode, but I can't tell you how much I adore it and how happy I am that you guys have made this show. I've heard some who haven't seen it yet compare it to the Larry Sanders Show, but I think it reminds me a lot more of my favorite year because you guys seem to have less of the snarky, mocking Hollywood tone and a lot more of, I guess, a real affection for the golden age of television and showmen like Johnny Carson that you don't see anymore.
That's an interesting observation. Yeah, it's... I'm thrilled. We're thrilled that you like it. And feel free to tell a friend.
I have.
And, part of the reason... We all had such affection for Johnny, and we started making this. I was kind of overwhelmed and surprised by the pulsing, very much alive affection that people walk around with. Jeff probably gets it all the time because he's working with Carson and Johnny's legacy daily. But you tell anybody we're doing the show, and they'd have a story about, my dad used to watch it. I used to watch it with my parents. And everybody has such a fond spot in their heart for Johnny.
There's an incredible connection to the show. People have incredible memories. People watch this religiously. We were talking about the fact that people would stay up till 11:30. Millions of people.
And that was part of the fun because I was 15 when this show was on. So it was, school night, high school. Mm-hmm. And you'd sneak it. I could try and sneak it. And I would call my shots. I'd probably watch... when I knew my favorites were going to be on, when George Carlin was on, mm-hmm. when Albert Brooks was on, when the comedians were on. It's, I think, part of the reason, well, Jeff can answer this better than me, but I think part of the reason that I think Jeff was able to take a shot with us and is that he knew that we held Johnny in esteem and that we had mm-hmm. great affection. And we had no desire to throw any mud at his beautiful legacy. Having Jeff around was really great because he was our authenticity expert. Mm-hmm. So he would sometimes be really minor, invaluable. But we care. Like the microphone is a different microphone, or like no, they wouldn't do that. They would cut away and then they'd come back. So he kept us on our toes. But it was a thrill because we rebuilt the set exactly
as it was.
And we've had people who were on the show. Johnny's secretary, who was a right hand person for many years, came on the set and just went, oh my goodness! And even the offices, which we kind of were designing, we had brilliant set designers who just, I guess, found old pictures and it looked like it did. So there's a real authentic feel to the show.
Well, I went back and watched your first appearance on Carson in 1982.
That was a big mistake.
What was that first experience like?
Well, what was it like for you, more important? Because I'm over
it. I thought you were funny.
I thought you were funny,
but it cut off the clip, and that's Jeff's fault because he's in charge of that clip. So I don't get to see if you got invited to the couch at the end of it.
See, that's what we did it on purpose. Right. No, I didn't get. It's so funny. Everybody, every civilian knows
that. They all want to know that.
You got the couch. I understand the couch is very significant. I didn't get the couch, but I got the a little thumbs up or some indication of
the okay sign.
The okay sign.
Or maybe he was giving me the big finger. I don't know what it might have been. But that was the only time that I did stand-up that I actually performed. Every time after that was I went straight to the couch and I did it, you know, as...
As a
ruse. You do material, but you pretend, you know, Johnny, I was just thinking, and then pull out a bit.
That was your health.
Yes.
Because that was
you
the
know,
same
phones
year.
Phones are very different today, Johnny.
Because that was the same year you did Diner. So right, from then on, you were on as an actor promoting a TV show.
Right, that was
film,
my first.
Guess, huh?
That was my first shot, was exactly the week that Diner came out. So it was in conjunction with that. And then a few years later, I started doing it pretty regularly. And, you know, for a comedian starting out, that's. I always said that's the end of the rainbow. That's as far as you could see.
Yeah.
And that was the only standard. Didn't matter what other shows you got on. You want to get on Johnny, and you want Johnny to like you. So I remember when I finally got there, it was exciting, but it wasn't surprising because we had, you know, we had pictured it. We had envisioned this moment. And then when you get there, you feel like, oh, this makes sense. This is exactly what I thought.
That was a big deal during the 80s comedy boom. You hear these stories of, you know, someone would get discovered at the Comedy Store by the booker on The Tonight Show. They go on The Tonight Show the next week, and the very next morning, suddenly they're getting networks with calling.
Yeah, I don't know how often
offers,
that actually happened, but
that's
that
the
was
legend,
certain, but that was part of a big part of why we wanted to start our show, There's Johnny, in 72, which is when the show moved to L.A.
Right.
And a couple of things. A, that's when, I think, in the shadow of that was where the Comedy Store developed, and then out of that, all the other places. So for years, you're watching, oh, there's Buddy Hackett, and there's, you know, Groucho Marx, there's Jerry Lewis. Suddenly, you're going, whoa, here's a new guy. Here's Steve Martin. Wow, that's different. Yeah. Here's Albert Brooks. Haven't seen that. And Johnny loved comics. Jeff, and you can speak to this. Was, am I correct that when he moved officially out to Burbank that the show took off in terms of numbers?
Very much so.
Yeah?
Really? Yeah, between the 70s and the 80s, that's when the show had its biggest audience.
And what was that number? What, do you remember?
I don't know the number, but I know that it was responsible for like 25% of the revenue for the entire network.
Wow. Is that right?
It's huge. Really huge.
25% from one show at 11:30 at night.
Yeah, a late night show, too.
Yeah.
That's wild.
And it's true that if you had a great stand-up on The Tonight Show, you'd be working Las Vegas the next week.
It happened. And I'm that wasn't my particular trajectory. I didn't wake up the next day with a career, but I certainly felt it out in the world that people saw you. But more importantly to me, it's like other comedians saw it. I remember one time I was at the Improv Comedy Club out here after I had done a Tonight Show, and Rodney Dangerfield, who had never spoken to me, came up and goes, "Hey, kid, that was quite a great set, great shot. Johnny really cracked up." And I went, "Wow, Rodney's watching. Right? It matters now."
You know, Rodney, that's funny. His part in Caddyshack was found by the producers and director watching him do a shot on the Tonight Show. You know, they said, "Oh, that's the guy."
And Johnny was a comic and so funny, but he was unlike many others who might have done it. He was so supportive and so rooting for you to do well because he looked great, right? He wasn't competing,
right?
So I mean, he just loved. I'd venture to say more than an actor.
Actors. I think it was important for him that the guest was successful and whatever he could do to make the guest more successful. That worked.
And he did it in a lot of ways. For comics, you're sitting there, we're all guests, you have a thing prepared, but you want to make it look natural.
Right.
And Johnny was masterful at telling you, at knowing when to interrupt, when not to interrupt, when to change the subject, when to sort of bolster you a little bit. And then also sometimes, you know, I had done bits that were not going over well, and he would just have this twinkle in his eye, like, "God, man, you started it." You're like, and that became funny. Just like he would, you know, bomb and get a laugh with a bad joke.
Yeah.
But there was one time that Jeff was mentioning that I did a bit, and it was about how annoying it is when people talk to you on a plane and they touch you, the guy sitting next to you, and he's touching your hand. You can't see it, but I'm doing that. And in my head, I don't know that I knew it, but I sensed that Johnny is one of those people that did not like to be touched, as
right.
my guess.
Right. Yeah, I would imagine.
But there was a moment where I was about to do the bit, and he intuited that it would have been funnier if I could lean on his arm. But his arm was not really close. So if he really wanted up, he just would have slid it over towards me, but that would have been kind of unsubtle and uncool. Yeah. And I didn't see it. I didn't notice it until I went home and I saw it on the air that night. What he did was he lifted his hand up to his face, scratched his nose a little bit, then reset his hand an inch closer to me right when I needed it to be there. I went, man, he's good. Yeah. Look at that.
Yeah. Now, at what point did you start looking back at those days on The Tonight Show and thinking, maybe this would be a good scripted series?
Did you ever, I mean, you had thought about it or people had approached you over the years, right?
Some different ideas of how to use this material, but the fact that Paul was a part of the show and was so successful with Johnny and had such great chemistry, it just seemed to work. And the script that you and David put together was fantastic.
Well, when we first pitched this to Jeff and we said, here's, because we knew it would, we really wanted to have the clips and you couldn't do that. I think even if we didn't have the show, we would want the blessing of the Carson company. But when we told Jeff, I said, listen, it's about this kid comes out and he doesn't know what he's doing with his life. And he gets this job, but he's screwing up and nobody can yell at him because Johnny likes him. And Jeff says, well, you know, that's my life story. I said, no, I didn't. I just met you. But that was, Uncle John.
Uncle John helped me out, yeah.
That was your coming of age story. Tell us a little bit about that. You were actually Johnny's nephew, right?
I am, yeah.
You are. You still are.
He graduated.
Yes, I did. No, I had a tremendous experience. I grew up in Philadelphia where, you know, I would go to New York and watch a show in the 60s. My Uncle Dick was the director, so I could sit in a booth and see all these tremendous acts. And I never thought for a minute that I would actually work on the show. And I got an opportunity to, as an entry-level job, like answering the phones and sorting the mail and in the 70s, and was able to turn that into a producer on the show. So I was very fortunate.
Now, and what was that actual moment when Uncle John said, was it just a casual thing? Was he? Did your parents go, we're worried about Jeff?
No. I was in Pasadena, going to Pasadena City College, studying 2-inch videotape editing.
Okay. Oh, so okay. You're already in there.
Yeah. And at a Christmas get together, he said to me, "What are you doing?" And he and I had, I don't know why, we had a connection. He gave me his drum set when I was a kid, so we connected. That we had a good sense of humor. My mom has a great sense of humor, and they were great friends. So we kind of shared that. And I said, "I'm studying tape editing at Pasadena." He said, "Really?" And I said, "Yeah." And about 4 or 5 months later, my mom called me and said, Uncle John called and said that the receptionist at the Tonight Show quit, and if you want to work there for the summer, it'd be an opportunity to learn.
What an experience. That. So somebody had to fall off the tree.
Yeah.
Well, and when I got there, they said, let me tell you what, this is the only job you're going to have at the Tonight Show because nobody leaves the show. And this is a great show to work on. So
what a fortuitous thing. Yeah. I forgot that piece that you were studying editing.
Yeah.
But still, Uncle John said, come in and work on as a whatever. It wasn't specifically for tape.
No, I think that he thought that it was just going to be a few months in the summer.
Mm-hmm. Because then, ironically, I think my sense was that it was go make yourself busy and stay out of trouble.
Right.
Yeah.
And up to Jeff is the one who actually cataloged and started archiving all the tapes. Up to that point, nobody had done it. And they didn't somehow, miraculously didn't, or unbelievably, didn't see the value of it. Right.
Yeah,
so then you said when they wanted to do a clip show, the reason
we
always saw the same 7 clips is because they didn't know what else they had.
Well, no, you couldn't find it.
You couldn't find it.
Before video cassettes.
Wow, that's amazing.
So Jeff went into the basement and came out 7 years later with, like, here it is. And then we ended up using that story in our series, which was perfectly – there were a lot of great moments that – weren't deliberately, we didn't take Jeff's life, but it kind of merged and became this thing.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, were there any particular experiences as a young man on the show that made it into There's Johnny?
Well, you know, a number, but it's so funny you say that because I think I told you this, that one thing that I did on the show was I tried to book talent, and I booked one person, and he was terrible. It was so bad, I can't.
Don't tell me it was Paul.
Well, I don't want to tell you who it was. No, just it was during... remember the show Real People with Skip Stevens?
Yes. Whatever. It wasn't Skip, it was somebody else. Okay.
And so this person was what we called a civilian. And bumped Stan Getz and put my guest on, and he was terrible. And as I walked out of the studio. Bobby Quinn, the director, walked past me and said, "Welcome to the NFL." And there's a scene where Tony walks by.
That's right.
It says, "Welcome to Hollywood." Right. Every time I see that, I go, "Oh man, that's exactly what it was like."
Talking about the civilian pieces, I think growing up, that was one of my favorites. And it sort of speaks to Johnny's Midwestern heritage that he liked to have some little grandma from Minnesota or whatever come up and show off her potato chip collection.
Well, it's
that
like,
looked like
it's
celebrities.
One of my favorite clips.
Yeah, the potato chip lady or the guy who has made jewelry from quail droppings, those kind of people.
I did the show once, and I remember the guest after me was this like 100-year-old piano teacher woman. But what also speaks to Johnny, you talk about his Midwest, but he was so many things to so many people, and they never conflicted. Yeah. He was hip. He was, you know, he got Albert Brooks. He got the really avant-garde comics. He loved the jazz guy. He loved singers. He could totally, you know, so he was conservative. He was edgy. He was a little bit bad boy, but he was, and he never, it's not like he changed hats. He just was himself. Yeah. And in a way that, and then, of course, with the civilians, you never felt like they were being patronized as they might be today.
Right.
Like Johnny just made them feel at home, or little kids. Like he just was so rock solid. And that was a great fun in researching and looking for clips. We just, you know, we'd get lost. I'm like, okay, we're watching clips for 6 hours. We should maybe write something.
Yeah.
But it was all fascinating.
Well, like when Joey Lawrence comes on, who's like 7 years old on the show, and Johnny says to him, have you ever seen this show before? And he says, once when I was up vomiting. This is great. You can't write that stuff.
Yeah, that makes me think of the lead actor in this show who plays Andy Klavan. He's only 22.
Now, Ian Nelson.
Did he have any reference for The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson when he came on this project?
It's interesting. He did, and he's really a terrific actor and did his research. And we were so lucky to find it because he really kind of is this kid. He's just this sweet kid who is thrown into this world, and he's just trying to do his best, the character. But we had a lot of actors exactly that who came in. They were 22 and said, "Yeah, I didn't know who Johnny Carson was." I went, "Are you kidding me?" And I thought, well, okay, he's been off the air 25 years, I suppose. But I don't know. I still feel like I knew who the Marx Brothers were. They were done when I got there. But you do your homework,
right?
You should know in all creative world. You should know what came before you.
You know, in my day, Jeff, I'm starting to become that cranky guy.
But there were people who, you know, that's another part of the exciting thing for me is. You know, you don't have to know Johnny Carson to enjoy this show.
True.
So there are many people like us who will go, "Oh, I love Johnny. Let's see what this is." And then you get hooked, hopefully, by the characters and the story. But for those people who are coming in who know nothing, they're going to leave going, "Oh, he's really good. And look who he had." And so we're getting to introduce Johnny in a really fun, unique way.
So you're not worried that millennials might not come to the show because they don't have that base reference.
No, you know, because again, I mean, Johnny is a big, glittery, sparkly bauble on this show, but it's not about Johnny. Yeah. It's about that world. Yeah. And when I was a kid, I go, it's sort of like you're going through your TV into this show. And just with this kid, he was in our character who plays Andy. You know, he's sitting in his house in Nebraska watching Johnny and 24 hours later, he's there on the set. It's like it's as if he fell through the set. And to me, you know, the show is really, it's about these really interesting characters. Mm-hmm. So I think you don't have to know anything. I think the millennials come in and watch it, and there's a surprise factor. I think this show is really hard to categorize.
Yeah,
it's a comedy for sure, but there's a lot of moving parts, and there's a lot of drama and a lot of surprises that I think are well-earned because you like these people, you know, and that's with any good TV show. You come every week because you like those characters.
Now, one person who's not portrayed by an actor on the show is Johnny Carson. You see him in the clips, but you don't actually have an actor playing Johnny, nor do you have Ed McMahon
or
Doc Severinsen. Was it just that those shoes were too big to fill?
Yeah, I think that very early on, we all felt, I mean, we didn't even discuss it. It just felt like, why would you want to do that? And it's gonna and then it also, it shakes the reality, because here's Johnny. We have Johnny. So why would you now have a guy? There are a couple of things. We see it in a long shot, and it's a blurry guy. He's about Johnny's height with gray hair and a nice suit. But that's just to sort of to give you the sense of reality. But no, Johnny was so in our homes and in our living rooms, in our bedrooms, you can't really fake it. But also my perspective, and I, you know, as gracious and as welcoming as he was to me, we never hung out. You know what I mean? I was, and I don't know if this was this way, Jeff, in the 70s, but when I was there in the late 80s and then in the 90s, you know, there was security. And when Johnny moved from dressing room to makeup to wardrobe, wherever he moved, everything was on lockdown. Like, there'd be a guard in the hall, like, everybody calm down, you know, and you just sensed it.
Yeah, right.
Right? And you just sensed it. And so literally all I would see, and I was there, I'd see a shoulder. I'd see a gray hair. Oh, there he went. And it was exciting. It was like the president, you know, like the entourage is moving. And there's Johnny. And that's where we got the name. It's like, there he is. Yep, he's just in the air and he's huge, but you didn't really see him.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot, that he would come in later in the day. He would, you know, get ready, do the show, and he wouldn't hang around after that. He was kind of a ghost. And, you know, there are some writers who claim that they never even met Johnny when they were working on the show.
I don't think so. The writers met him, for sure. Oh, okay. But he definitely, you know, it was a well-oiled machine. He had it down.
And who ran it? Would that be Freddie?
Yeah.
Freddie
and Peter LaSalle.
Hmm. Freddie DeCordova, the producer of the old Tonight Show, and he's played brilliantly by Tony Danza. What was Freddie like? Did you guys ever interact with him?
Yeah.
Well, sure, we both did.
Yeah, we both did. But go ahead, Jeff. Yeah. You worked with him every day.
Well, you know, he was the Tonight Show greeter. He was the figurehead. He was the guy that could schmooze you. And he was wonderful with talent, and he was great at what he did. He was the gatekeeper, right?
He was the gatekeeper. My experience with him was only as the schmoozer. Uh-huh. Yeah. And he was so good at it that we used to look forward to it. And my wife and I would go to the show, and, you know, getting dressed, and you're always nervous, you always want to do great. And about 20 minutes before the show, there's a little knock on the door, and Freddie's there, and with a cigarette and a drink, and he just looks like a million bucks with a perfect suit and tie. And he would just make a couple of little jokes, and a little just joke for the wife, a little joke for you. And sometimes you don't even know what he said, but it sounded exactly right.
He's so smooth.
And he'd leave and go, that's an art, man, to just do that. And I would not have been happy if he didn't come in and do. I don't know what he did, but it helped. But he must have done more than that, didn't he?
Well, I think the bottom line is Peter is pretty much running the show.
Peter LaSalle, brilliant guy.
And he had a real feel for how to book guests that would work well with Johnny. But Fred is the person that everybody wanted to go to. Everybody wanted to have Fred's blessing. And
Fred was very old school Hollywood. So he had. He directed Ronald Reagan. My buddy Ronnie.
Really?
In Bedtime for Bonzo.
You're kidding me. I didn't know that.
Oh, really?
For years, Johnny would always do these Bedtime for Bonzo jokes. I remember that movie? Because he was needling Freddie, right?
I got that.
Yeah, or Fred would get an invitation to the White House. You know, and Johnny didn't. So why is that?
but you're right. Tony Danza is the only a character actor that we have a real character. So Freddie's based on a real. We were going to get cute and call him, you know, Eddie Schmimnotaba. Yeah. It's like, well, let's call it Freddie. And Tony Danza knew him also, so he knew him. He knew him very well. I think they socialized. But
Tony Danza was a guest host.
Yeah.
So when he was a guest host, he had to work with Fred professionally. So and he was. Yeah.
But he's
did a million shots too.
Yeah, and he's so good. You know, and it's one of the thrills. Tony is one of these guys who just gets better and better. And he's such a likable guy. And you hang out with him, and you're out in the street with him. Everybody loves Tony. Then you just watch his work, and he's not playing Tony. He's really playing Freddie, who had this very sort of arch, or maybe I just remember it that way. He just spoke very flowery and a little extra fancy and uptown, and Tony just wrapped himself into this role, and he's so good. It's really great.
Yeah, he's terrific.
I remember Bob Newhart at Fred's funeral, I think, said that he had this recollection of Fred coming up to him during the commercial break, and he said, during the next segment, try and say something amusing.
That's exactly the kind of thing you do. Yeah, and then you laugh, and he'd walk away.
That's real encouraging.
Yeah.
Because everybody, you know, smart comics know, walk away on the laugh.
Yeah.
He would get his laugh, and he would disappear.
Yeah.
But we have it shot for shot. When you see, you know, we cut to Tony sitting next to his monitor, it blends in so perfectly. Because America knew Freddie, whether they knew who it was or not. Like, we've seen this guy, and he's the guy with the big square glasses with a cigarette laughing at Johnny.
Yeah, you guys do a great job of blending in the original footage from The Tonight Show with what's going on the set and the scripted part.
We had really smart set designers and cinematographers, and they really made it. You know, there's a color palette to the show that in the back of your brain, you wouldn't know, but you go, that's why it's 70s. There's like a sort of
it's
a brown thing. It's like, I don't remember the 70s being brown. But it seems to be.
And how did you guys pick the clips that you used in the show? How did you decide to tie them in?
How did we pick that, Jeff?
I think that we had discussions about moments that happened during the show, and then mm-hmm. looked at the clips and see if we could write around them, and Paul and David did that.
Mm-hmm. It went a lot of different ways. Once or twice we had a clip that we remembered that we wanted to use. Like there's one episode, and we all remembered this dog food commercial, and Alive. Now, Fido here certainly loves the taste of this natural beef, and then the dog wouldn't eat it. And it was hysterical. And then on the show, what happened was Johnny Carson came in, and he saved the day, and he made some great improv comedy out of it. And we thought, if we had to write backwards, why wouldn't the dog eat? What did the kid do that messed up our dog?
You could build a whole episode. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So we built the story. But most of the other times, it was either because I wanted to see people that I liked. So let's find George Carlin. Let's find Albert Brooks. There's Rodney on there. And
Dr. Anshel moment is so wonderful. I mean, you're watching this psychologist who is talking about how the world is falling apart because of
values and perversion. And he was a sex doctor in our very first episode. And this is where the talent bookers come in and they do their job. So they book George Carlin with this guy. So you're sitting next to each other. You had the polar opposites of the culture from 1972. Mm-hmm. So George doing his things about getting arrested for the words, and you know, seven words you can't say on television. And then this guy comes in and is talking about perversion. So you can just sense the audience going, oh, George, you got to get at this guy, straighten this guy out. And then there's a shot, and we kept it in there, of Johnny, as the sparks were flying, Johnny just looks in the camera and sort of winks like, how about this? Ain't this fun? And you go, oh, son of a gun. They knew it. They knew this would be fun. And as friction-y as they got, there was a civility. And at the end, we weren't able to keep this in our show, but at the end, the very last shot of that show, of the actual Tonight Show, George extends a warm hand and says, forgive me if I seemed rude. I was really just trying to understand you, man. And I thought, whoa, that's a moment you don't see now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? They're actually different people trying to understand each other.
You know, I almost wonder if today's late night shows, guest bookers on those shows really take into consideration the mixture of the panel. When you get everyone on the couch.
There, it's now you sit down and you're gone.
You just move on.
It's a lost art, too, I think. Yeah. I think that, you know, when we were on the show, if you did the Tonight Show, you couldn't do another talk show for like 2 weeks. And now you can do a talk show tomorrow. I think there's tremendous pressure to get people on the show.
Yeah.
So, but you don't really stick around.
Yeah,
you know,
that's interesting.
Right? Somebody comes out and they're a little... Well, I think what's...
I think you're right.
They don't really interact anymore, right?
Yeah, not like that. Because you used to get all kinds of great interactions between the different
guests.
Yeah,
and there was an era of funny unexpectedness. Person, you'd have the big... Or you'd have maybe a beautiful actress and... I don't know if somebody said, make sure you wear a very revealing dress, whatever. But and Ed and Johnny would be doing jokes like not quite raunchy, but everybody knows, and probably the actress knows too, or the model, whatever. But they're playing the role of the sexual object. So these double entendres are flying overhead, and you wouldn't do that now, and you certainly wouldn't do it this month.
Yeah,
right.
To answer your original question of how do we pick the clips, sometimes we just looked for clips that gave you a taste of what the world was like then. So there was one...
we looked at jokes about Vietnam.
Yeah, when we were looking for a Vietnam joke, we couldn't find anything with really any bite to it. Because Johnny didn't do that. Johnny, if he did a Vietnam, it would be about how badly Henry Kissinger's flight was coming back. He wouldn't take sides. And we wrote a scene that Tony Danza did beautifully, where he lectures the comics. It's like, you don't ever make a joke like that. You don't. Do you even know what Johnny thinks? No, you don't, because Johnny. Yeah. And you're thinking,
no one knows.
Right, nobody knows, and you can project onto him whatever it is that makes you comfortable.
Which is so different than today, where all of the late night comics are probably rightly so are piling on to Donald Trump, but I don't think Johnny would have ever done that because he played both sides.
Right, the story
everyone
about
was fair game.
They were giving it to Richard Nixon in the monologue, and there was a story that Nixon was up late and drinking and was very upset about that, and Johnny said, that's it, no more. We're not doing any more Nixon jokes.
Wow. When he was in office.
When he was in office, they were hammering him.
No more Nixon jokes.
Yeah, no more.
Really?
Man.
That's why I stopped doing them. Yeah. Also, it's a little too late. But I got a good one if
everything
he comes back.
Comes back.
Yeah.
Did Johnny ever sit with the writers and punch up the jokes? Or
You know, because the show was on for so long, I think they did it originally in New York. and they kind of stopped in the 70s. And then when I became associate producer and the producer, we had regular meetings with Johnny at his house. So every week we'd go to his house and we'd sit around and spitball ideas.
In the afternoon.
In the morning.
In the morning.
Every Monday Monday morning.
So we have a thing, it's in, I think, our second episode, where the kid has to get the jokes to Johnny's house. Uh-huh. And I think that was based, in the show, it's like he had to be there at 12. Not 5 after 12, not 5 before 12, at 12.
On the dot.
And that was literally the way it was?
Yeah, basically there was a team of 3 or 4 different writers who would write 4 or 5 monologues, and they would give them to the receptionist, which I was at the time, call a messenger. The messenger would pick up the envelope, drive the envelope to Johnny's house in Beverly Hills, and then Johnny would come in with the envelope and the monologues circled with the jokes that he liked and an order.
Yeah,
that's
wild.
Yeah.
I mean,
you
sound like Johnny, by the way, right now. That's wild.
But we had joke. A line that we put in the show where the kid, they need somebody, and the writers don't want to take it because it's like they'll shoot the messenger.
Oh,
so
so
give it to this green kid, the new kid. And as he's running out the door, the writer says, you cannot lose this. If you lose this, America will have no jokes tonight. Do you want America to have? And that's what it was. So as you're sitting here now telling me they sent a messenger, I'm going,
a messenger?
That can go wrong.
Yeah.
They didn't have a guy who just, wow.
There's no fax
email
machine.
Back
I can remember when,
fax,
when we finally had a fax machine, okay? So we could actually fax the monologue to Johnny's house. And he would come in with these stacks of paper. Remember how it was all curled? How do you change toner? I need toner. What does that mean?
The writer's room does feature pretty prominently, and there's Johnny. You see them nervously waiting to see their jokes go over, see how Johnny delivers his monologues and whether it's a
flop or you live and die. And literally, they would get fired, right, at some
13
point?
13 weeks.
That's
every
what
13
I've
weeks,
heard.
So they wouldn't get fired every 13 weeks, but you were vulnerable.
Some guys did.
Right. Some people did.
Yeah, I had Al Jean and Ed Weinberger on, and they said, Johnny would fire you and then rehire you 6 weeks later.
Right. Maybe he's funnier now.
Yeah. They said their fortunes literally did rise and fall with every monologue. Has to have been pretty nerve-wracking to be a writer on The Tonight Show, huh?
Yeah, well, and we had a lot of fun with that because it's such a shared experience. So, you know, everybody in the production is just, you just want to make this show great, make Johnny look good, make Johnny happy. Anything short of that is bad.
Yeah.
So you're just walking on eggshells, and it's different, really, than most workplaces. It's like, it's make this guy shine.
Now, one writer on the show who got a little bit more leeway from Johnny was, of course, the legendary Pat McCormick. Jeff, I've heard all kinds of Pat McCormick stories over the year. Do you have a particular favorite? Or did you was he around during your era there?
Oh yeah, for sure.
You interacted.
He was never a regular. He had sort of a sort of specialized position, didn't he?
He was just come and go. I mean, he was there for a couple of years when
that's
I was
what
there.
I heard.
He had some memorable moments at some parties. So,
he was, and America would know. I mean, he was big. He was like 6'4", 6'6", huge guy, and crazy funny.
Yeah,
and we actually had a Pat McCormick character in the story, and then we ended up just sort of trimming it, and we didn't know who he is, and it just seemed so strange. But we did take one of his stories and amend it.
Yes.
So there is in there a story that, let's say, is inspired in the Pat McCormick craziness.
Yeah, and
I can't say it is.
Can I just say helicopter?
Maybe you could, maybe you couldn't. Again, I can't say anything.
Okay,
that's
all I needed.
Okay. But there were a lot of stories. And what we basically did, we took a lot of stuff that was in the air and piece. We spoke to some of the writers, and of course Jeff had lots of stories. And then we fictionalized it. So, you know, nothing is literal. Although there was one episode that we did that was based on a true event where there was an extortion plot on Johnny. And he woke up and there was on his lawn was a threatening note and
a hand grenade.
A hand grenade, a fake grenade. Jeez. And they brought in the police and they brought in the FBI. And I didn't know about it then. It was pretty kept a secret.
70s.
In the 70s.
Early 70s.
And then I read about it recently only. It's like, and it reads like a novel. I go, are you kidding?
Yeah.
So Johnny, there was a drop.
Yeah, I heard
and they had to
story.
Drop the money, and Johnny insisted on going. And Johnny and he gets there with an FBI guy, and the FBI guy sees that Johnny's packing a gun in his belt. And he goes, oh, my, you can't say no to Johnny Carson. So we said, we can't not use that.
Yeah.
So we took that story, and we, you know, expanded it and made it ours.
Along those lines, I have to ask, Jeff, is it true that at one point, I've heard this story, Johnny had a stalker, and the way that he dealt with it is he, at one point, he just decided to hire the person, and they ended up becoming a reception and got over their obsession with Johnny Carson and then became obsessed with Paul McCartney or something.
No, I've never
Have
heard
you ever heard that?
That's how Jeff got the job.
One
Were
time.
You the stalker?
That's really, I never heard that. Guy.
Yeah, I've heard that repeated a couple of times. There was the Johnny had a stalker, and at one point he's like, well, yeah, let's just give him a job. And then he left him alone. He never bothered him after
Jeff is
that.
Here to shatter that myth. But that's that would do it for anybody.
Yeah,
right. You think you love somebody, spend a week with them.
Yeah, there you go.
Get him coffee a couple of times.
Now, I've always heard that he was kind of withdrawn and kind of shy, wasn't terribly social. Do you think that that was part of it, kind of the cost of fame and the fact that you had people showing up and harassing you and wanting to extort you or kidnap you or
God knows
what?
I think to be a star at his level is difficult. Mm-hmm. It's tough. And to be in the public eye for 30 years is tough, not easy.
We had such an intimacy with this guy.
Right.
We didn't know. You don't really know him. So anything you find out about anybody famous, like, oh, I heard he was, you know, I heard he really doesn't like cheese on the cheeseburgers. Like, well, no. You know, there's always some colorful little piece of information. It's like, no, they're real people, but we know them. I don't know where that cheese was going. That was, I had a joke in mind and it went away. But that's, to his enormous credit, is that he was in our homes for 30 years, more? 30 years,
well,
30 plus.
Yeah, 30
and,
plus.
And it's an intimate relationship. And the other thing that kept coming up and hitting me on the head about the 1972-ness of it, we didn't have even video recorders. So, yes, you stayed up. Mm-hmm. And, yes, you made an appointment. And if you missed it, you missed it. Somebody would tell you, oh, you should have seen it. Well, it's gone.
It's gone.
It's gone. So until Jeff started keeping the tapes, and now at least we can watch them. But
and we're talking not about a million people. We're talking 25 million people every night. Lot of people. A lot of awareness.
Yeah, and you're right. There is a certain intimacy to the idea that you're watching him at 11:30, not prime time. You might be watching him in your bedroom instead of with the family in the living room.
Yeah, there's something also about television that's different than a movie. You know, you go to the movies and it's like they're 15 feet tall. You're in somebody's home, there's intimate. And I know when I was on TV a lot, when Mad About You was on, people would come over and they would just pick up a conversation that from the show, like, oh, you know what you should have said to Jamie? You should have said, I'm like, whoa, that was a make-believe. But, you know, but we were invested. So magnify that by a zillion, and that's what Johnny Carson was. He was in your home, and he was a welcome part. And it really was, I mean, to this day, I think that's why people have been responding to this so positively, to our show. It's like, still miss him.
He's so
still
funny.
Miss
yeah,
him.
I think so. Yeah, it's funny. When I look back at those old episodes and I think back to staying up late to watch Johnny Carson as a kid, and I compare that to late shows today, not to denigrate Jimmy Fallon or Conan or any of these guys, it just seems like there's something missing. And I don't know if I'm being nostalgic, I don't know if it's a secret ingredient that I can't put my finger on, or if it is the fact that it was that appointment television that just doesn't exist now in the digital on-demand era.
Yeah, I think that period of history is over. And I'm not saying it's even bad. It's just, it is. We're never going to have three channels, and we're never going to not have the ability to watch whenever we want. And listen, all these guys who are great, and Jimmy Fallon is great, and Jimmy Kimmel and Steve Colbert and everybody, they've all found their own little niche, and they will all tell you, Conan, you know, be the first to tell you, because, yeah, we're just only doing this because we grew up watching and idolizing Johnny. He set the tone.
Between Stranger Things on Netflix and Red Oaks on Amazon, and now you've got There's Johnny, which was originally developed for CISO. Now it's premiering on Hulu. Paul, you're kind of becoming the king of streaming television, I think.
I like to think of myself as the king. And, yeah, you know, that's just all a nice, happy coincidence. And when we started the show, it was more people are hearing about CISO now that it's dead than knew about it when it was on.
It's amazing.
True. But you know, one of the reasons we liked it, we met with a whole bunch of people, but I liked that it was a small network that looked to us to sort of help build them up. That we were by far their biggest show, and I don't know what happened behind the scenes and why they, you know, NBC Comcast decided to close that up. But I have to say, to their credit, NBC Comcast, I was in communication with one of the women executives there, and she was She said, "Listen, we're going to close CECIL, but we're going to find a home for this." And and she said, "Listen, we could still put you on. We're still broadcasting. We're still streaming for 6 months." She said, "But why?" She said, "The show is too good." And I think whether it was ever articulated or not, there's a responsibility that we're all kind of carrying Johnny's legacy. Yeah. So you can't put Johnny in a show and then go, "Yeah, we canceled it." No.
Yeah.
You've got to let people. This is too good and special. So we're riding his coattails all the way, baby.
Yeah, you bet.
No, but so I know they were talking to a lot of people, and when they finally landed us at Hulu, I thought that's perfect.
At this point in your career, do you find the flexibility of this format, digital streaming media, and places like Hulu and Amazon more appealing than doing a network sitcom like Mad About You again?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just nice to have more options. Mm-hmm. You can have an idea for the 10 episodes and then be done if you wanted. You could do 2 years. It's no longer, you don't have to come up with the gangbuster 9-season mega hit. So there's a lot, people will say the downside is there's such a fragmented audience, but the reality is you can get around to it all. Mm-hmm. I watch shows that have been out for a year or two because I'm just can't get there in time.
I think it was just 2 months ago that it was the 25th anniversary of Johnny's final show. Jeff, what was that like? Did your uncle handle that night pretty well, or was it emotional for him, I imagine, afterwards?
They didn't do standing ovations every night on the Tonight Show. They just did it every now and then. Well, for the last month, he got a standing ovation every night. And every day, it got longer and longer and longer. If you watch the last show, the monologue, the applause goes on for so long, he stands there and he says, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. It's enough.
Did you have to cut?
Because we didn't edit anything.
You never did.
We never had the ability to edit.
Wow.
And
even at the end, you could.
No.
Really?
It was not even digital. Because you still had analog.
And it had to be on New York in
hour and a half. So it was an incredible deal. And it was an unbelievable moment to work on that show right across the street from where we're at.
Yeah.
Did you know when he said he was going to quit and make it his last year, did you have any heads up?
Yeah.
You knew?
Yeah.
Really?
He told me that he was going to go and make the announcement at the...
Upfronts.
Upfronts.
Really?
Yeah.
Of course, as I recall, he kind of vaguely threatened that every time his contract was up for renewal, was it, didn't he?
Well, I think some negotiation plays.
But my recollection is, or maybe it was the way it was portrayed in the books and movies, that he was sort of going, he was sort of sticking it to, happy to stick it to people that he felt were...
Well, it's funny, the networks had taken 5 minutes out of the show so they could show the war in...
The Gulf War.
The Gulf War. And they decided that they weren't going to give it back. And they still haven't given it back. All the late night shows started at 11:35. And he was really upset about that. And when he found that out, when he was in New York, he said, "You know what? I was going to leave in October, but I'm not. I'm going to leave in May."
Wow.
And that's when he walks off and Bob Wright is mortified.
Wow.
Really? So while he was there, he found that out.
Yeah.
That's wild.
He said, We're not going to give that back. We like that 5 minutes.
Well, there'll never be another. Before we go, I have to ask both of you, what's your favorite moment from The Tonight Show?
Jeff, go ahead.
I think it's when things aren't going great and he's able to come up with some incredible lines. I mean, there's a funny story when he's with Rodney Dangerfield, and Rodney Dangerfield is just firing all cylinders, and he sits down and he says to Rodney says to Johnny, "Johnny, you and Ed have been together for 30 years. No kids?" And he gets this huge laugh. And Johnny just waits and said, "Well, it's not like we haven't tried."
That's
great. So bad.
How about you?
He was masterful at that. Like, he knew, like, get the laugh. If they're laughing, just wait it out. And then he would often come in. I mean, there were so many. From a very narcissistic point of view, I mean, I remember one day getting a particularly unrehearsed laugh on an ad-lib, something. He asked me a question, and I said something, and he literally shot back in his chair laughing. And I was like, "Oh, I'm like in heaven now. That's an actual laugh. That was not being polite." Mm-hmm. I actually cracked Johnny up. And it was because the audience loved when he laughed.
Yeah.
And I remember, it was such a sustained laugh, or it might have been 3 seconds, but in my head, it was longer than I was ready for. And I remember thinking, I don't know what to do now. They're just laughing. I have no, you know, what do I do? It was like riding a big wave. Whoa, just hang in there. But that was an exciting moment, to get a genuine laugh from somebody you admire so much.
To make you laugh, big deal.
Well, again, season one of There's Johnny debuts on Hulu November 16th. Paul Reiser and Jeff Sotzing, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Paul and Jeff for coming on the podcast. Season one of There's Johnny is now available on Hulu, and I highly recommend it. It's just a great show with a lot of laughs and a lot of heart, a great cast. It's wonderful nostalgia for a Carson fan like me, but it's also fresh enough to hold up on its own as well. Just watch the first episode, and I promise you, you'll love it. Keep up with Paul at paulreiser.com or on Twitter at @paulreiser. And for all kinds of fun Carson-related stuff, including memorable clips from The Tonight Show, visit Jeff's website at johnnycarson.com. Today's episode was sponsored by Nadex. You know, more investors are getting into day trading to take advantage of market downturns instead of watching helplessly from the sidelines. The problem? Day trading can be risky, and trading the downside can be confusing. But binary options on Nadex let you day trade with risk protection built in. You decide your maximum risk and reward, and you can never lose more. And trading downturns is just as easy as trading rallies. Try day trading for yourself on the first and largest American binary options exchange. Trade stock indexes, commodities, Forex, even economic numbers. See why over 100,000 members choose Nadex. Find out more at nadex.com. That's NADEX.com. Trading on Nadex involves risk and may not be appropriate for all investors. Now, you know, folks, we love having great advertisers support our show, but in order to keep doing that, we need your help. So please do us a favor and go to podcastlistener.com/kick to answer a few short questions. It would be really helpful to us. Again, that's podcastlistener.com/kick. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.